Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Pamela Mahoney Sigdennis is an award-winning U.S.-based author and writer. She is internationally recognized for her writing on the limitations of reproductive medicine and the personal and social impacts that accompany fertility challenges. Her book, Silent Sorority, became the first account of reconciling infertility that was not written by a mother. With raw honesty, Pamela drew from her experience to explore the stigma associated with fertility issues and the complex effects of living involuntarily childless. Her book and her research and her writing introduced Pamela to a vibrant community of IVF survivors. Her follow-up ebook, Finally Heard, gives voice to a large but seldom acknowledged population of women struggling with the trauma of failed fertility treatments. Her writing raised provocative, often uncomfortable questions, usually reserved for late-night reflection or anonymous blogging. Her piece titled The Wild World of IVF Explained was part of a Marie Claire package nominated for a 2019 Ellie Award by the American Society of Magazine Editors. She was named a top 10 health blogger by the Times Inc. Health Magazine in 2015. Pamela regularly collaborates with an international team of researchers and academics. She is one of the co-authors of a Fertility and Sterility Journal article titled, Do a la carte menus serve infertility patients? It was the basis for an op-ed she wrote for the New York Times titled, The Big IVF Add-on Racket. Pamela was also the co-founder of the grassroots initiative ReprotectTruths.org. Formed ahead of the unregulated IVF industry's 40th anniversary campaign. Using the hashtag UnmaskingIVF, Reprotech Truths provided a counter-programming platform for women to share the long-lasting impacts of failed IVF. To date, Pamela continues to write and serve on several cross-discipline working groups monitoring assisted reproductive technologies. Pamela, it's so great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining me on Venus Rising.
I really appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation.
Yeah, I was actually reading your piece that you wrote, The Wild World of IVF Explained. And when I was reading it, I just kept thinking, I have to have her on our show. She is the voice we don't often get to hear. So thank you. And before we kind of talk about your books and your research and your writing, I would like our listeners to understand how you became involved in the fertility conversation. Your story is not one that the public gets to hear often. So do you mind sharing your personal story with us?
Certainly. And it's a story that I'm sure a lot of other women will relate to because nobody is particularly comfortable disclosing topics about their body and their lives that are so private. We have been socialized to keep a lot of this stuff very much under wraps. And I stumbled into it in a rather unusual way. I had just completed a dozen years of difficulty having a family with my husband. So I had just turned 40 and was realizing that I wasn't comfortable with the complications that would present if I were to get pregnant. My first attempt at trying to start a family was when I was 29 years old. So over the course of a decade, we had sort of attempted various doctor appointments and diagnostic testing and various surgeries to try to address what were considered the unexplained infertility category, which is quite broad. I'm sure as most people who've delved into this topic know, there's still a huge amount of information that is unknown in both the world of clinical and medical intervention and just the way that our bodies operate. So sort of at a place where I realized we had reached the end of the line and I still was feeling a lot of sadness and trauma and difficulty understanding the limitations of reproductive medicine and biology. I just sat down to blog one night and it was new. I was doing it anonymously. And over the course of several months, women from around the world started reaching out to comment and ask questions. And in the course of this, a reporter from the New York Times was Googling infertility bloggers and stumbled across my blog, which at the time was called Coming to Terms, and asked me if I would be willing to be interviewed for a health feature. This is a long way of saying that I was doing my best to keep this all very much outside the public realm, so to speak. And when she asked if I'd be willing to go on the record, I was very nervous about that. I'll stop there and let you ask a question.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course you'd be nervous about it. It's a very private matter, and it's something that you and your husband had been dealing with or going through for 10 years. I can't imagine the toll that that put on your relationship or your health or just your overall well-being. Can you talk about that, like your journey during that 10-year period?
Yeah, it's, I think everybody comes into this with a very, how shall we say, unprepared state of mind. Nobody really is, I guess, in a position to understand that something that you sort of grow up taking for granted may be denied to you. And so with each sort of conversation, whether it's with your primary care physician or with your OBGYN or talking to a specialist, you're sort of reaching around in the dark, trying to understand where you fit and what are the various biological inhibitors. And, you know, with the two of us, my husband and myself, we both had factors. I had a little bit of endometriosis. He had some varicocele, which meant that he produced less sperm, and my uterus was not particularly friendly to conception. And so we kept attempting to try to make adjustments where necessary. And we kept thinking, this is, you know, not a big deal. With each month, you think the next month you're going to be successful because you clear away some of the barriers. And what you learn over time is there's a real compounding effect. With each doctor appointment, you're just another patient. But if you're the patient, it's your entire focus. And your life starts to revolve around it. And people around you start to become pregnant and talk about their children and their births and their pregnancies. And at the same time, you're going through a monthly reminder of failure and that sadness that goes with it. So it's a real complex concern because you're thinking about it physically, you're feeling it personally, you're dealing with these competing emotions. And at the same time, you realize that the medical industry is an industry. And so there's a financial pressure there. Right. We could talk for days, I'm sure, about all these different topics, but I don't want to go too far off into the weeds here.
No. As you were thinking about that, I was thinking of some books that I've read, and it's almost like you're in Vegas, right? And you keep thinking, I'm going to win the next time, right? I've already invested so much money into this and time that the next cycle will work. The next thing will work. And we seem to live in this culture, especially when it comes to babies and family, of like not giving up, right? Like, don't give up. So how did you make that decision then to walk away from the table, so to speak, or to stop those fertility treatments? What was that like for you?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question because it's nonlinear. We took a couple of breaks over the course of the years that we were trying because we needed it for our sanity. We also needed it for our bank account. And we felt like we needed to give our bodies a break. It's not a very easy thing to talk about because the hardest part with dealing with infertility are the compounding losses that go with it. And with the more invasive surgeries and the more invasive attempts, you become very much bonded with your embryos. And so you get a room set aside in your house that's going to be the nursery. You start collecting baby clothes because you've just been sort of programmed to believe that you will succeed at some point. And to box up those baby clothes and to tell yourself that you're done is not something that you are necessarily going to do in one day or one week or one month. You sort of have a fits and starts attempt. And I think the other thing that is very real about this is you have to reconcile how much loss you can tolerate. I've actually decided over the course of the decades I've been writing and thinking about this topic is that society has done a real disservice to women and men who are undergoing fertility treatment because they don't explain the attachment that you get when somebody says, your embryos are beautiful, your children are going to be so amazing, because they speak to you throughout the process as though you are pregnant. And the alpha pregnancies do occur in the 2 weeks that they transfer your embryos and you're feeling very pregnant, only to find out in a rather calculated cold way when the phone call comes that they want to schedule your next appointment because your cycle didn't work. It suddenly becomes a clinical conversation and not, hey, you've miscarried or you've lost your child. It's your cycle was a failed cycle. So there's a real disconnect there. Mm-hmm. And to answer your question directly, my husband and I decided that the pain of the loss was getting so horrible that it would actually be easier to be a family of two than to continually live that painful trauma.
To piggyback off of that and the loss that you talk about, in your writing, I saw that you talk a lot about the lack of a cultural framework to process this loss that comes with infertility. So what do you think we as a culture could do to better support those struggling with infertility? Or how, if we have any listeners listening who might have friends or family or themselves going through this, how can we support them and make like cultural changes so that we're not putting this in the shadows, so to speak, anymore, or, you know, really, so we can really support women and couples who are going through this?
I appreciate that question because it's a really central one. I do believe that the United States is far behind many other countries. I've talked to women in Australia. I've talked to women in the UK. I've talked to women in South Africa and in New Zealand. And what I've learned is that the fact that we have a for-profit medical industry in the United States automatically puts couples here at a very big disadvantage because we have been socialized to believe that if you throw enough money at any problem, that you can ultimately get the outcome you're looking for. So we are dealing with both a medical establishment that is very much about keeping people in treatment. We don't have a safe space to talk about the fact that there are, you know, a set of individuals who, despite what science can continue to claim and make promises about, doesn't always live up to what they have put in the general consumption of media. So, you know, I think one way to address this question may be to take a different tack, and that is, I have taken great comfort in knowing that prior to 1978, there were a whole subset of couples and individuals who were not parents, and they weren't penalized for it. I think there was a real turning point in the introduction of IVF as an alternative procedure that put people in a position of defensiveness because, as I sometimes say to folks, nobody ever walks up to a person who's just delivered a child and said, "Why did you become a parent?" They just assume that that's a normal course of a human experience. So I think the first thing is to help people understand that it's a very complex question that my husband and I get pretty routinely. Yeah. And people will ask us, "Do you have children?" And we honestly don't know how to answer that question. We did at one point have a hope for children and we prepared for children. And so I would say the first thing you can do is when you meet somebody, don't ask if they have children. Let them volunteer. And as I've told many people over the years, the best icebreaker question for anybody is, "Tell me something about yourself." Mm-hmm. Because that allows the individual to move the conversation in any direction they see fit. Right. So I think the first and foremost is don't make assumptions about the fact that everyone can have children, because over the centuries, it's been proven that there are a lot of people in the world who just are incapable of conceiving and delivering children.
That's a great answer. And I love that question of saying that. I get asked that a lot. My husband and I don't have children, but we actually do foster care. And that's the way that we've chosen right now to welcome little ones into our house. And so I also sometimes struggle with that question as well. So thank you for answering that. And, you know, you touched on the fact that this kind of all began in the 70s. And it's crazy to me how much growth the fertility industry has seen in the last 50 years. Like it's crazy. It's exponential growth. And it seems like now there is an answer to every reproductive problem. But do you think that perhaps we've created more problems than we've been solving by using these types of technologies? And do you think the American people are misguided about the success of this industry?
You know, it's an interesting topic, because I know that there have been lots of bioethicists and, you know, individuals who look at the broader implications of what happens when you introduce new treatments. And, you know, I want to say up front that I also know a lot of couples who've been helped with IVF. And I think when it's an evidence-based procedure and, you know, people are really well educated about the potential difficulties that are presented by this particular procedure, I want to be careful not to impugn the entire industry, because I know there are responsible practitioners whose, you know, hearts and minds and souls are in the right place. But we have gotten to a place, though, where it has been normalized so much that it does seem to, you know, in a sense, sweep under the rug many of the problems that have also been introduced along with it. Well, I do think one of the more important elements here is to understand the real big implications that come and the responsibility that also is very much a part of this whole conversation. No one should ever make the mistake of thinking that couples enter into this without giving it serious, very serious consideration. I do think that as a rule, if there were an opportunity to introduce either in the primary care experience or certainly in the OBGYN, a better education, maybe a curriculum that helps to introduce the real deficiencies that exist around IVF, so that people are not walking into it blind, and that couples have a better understanding. And this is long before any fertility issues are identified, that there are some real serious limitations to what science and medicine can offer.
From what I understand, or from what I see, I don't think that people completely understand that. I think that we kind of, as a society, think science can kind of solve everything and don't understand that there are limitations. And I want to touch back on your, oh, go ahead, please.
I was going to say, along those same lines, you know, I'm not sure most people have their favorite TV series and streaming programs, but I remember watching a really well produced, and it was a period piece. It was after World War II, and it took place in the UK. And there was a physician who was counseling one of his patients about a very sad diagnosis, and the patient understood that the condition that they had, and it had nothing to do with fertility or reproduction. But the physician sat down with the patient and said in the most compassionate voice I'd ever heard, "It's my responsibility as your caregiver to not fall into the trap of selling you or sharing, imparting false hope." And it's really important for all of us to understand the importance of knowing when you are serving somebody by helping them realize that maybe the outcome they were looking for isn't necessarily going to be in the cards for them. And that's not an easy thing to do. I think compassion and empathy, especially in the world in which we live today, is very much in short supply because everyone's feeling very stressed and very much at their wit's end. But it is again, a sort of a quiet need to understand and embrace that sometimes the best thing you can do for somebody is to help them understand the reality before them and to be there for them as a good listener, as someone who doesn't try to be prescriptive or dictate what are the logical, you know, ways to move forward, but to just sit with someone and allow them to be sad, allow them to grieve, allow them to know that there are going to be some bumpy roads ahead of them. I think the women I've really treasured the most through all of this are those who have just said, you know, I can't even begin to understand what you're going through, but I'm there to listen if you want to talk about it.
So you took your personal story and you created your first book, right? And that book is your personal story. And I love your subtitle of the book, actually, and I'll read it for our listeners. It's called Silent Sorority, A Barren Woman Gets Busy, Angry, Lost, and Found. Can you tell us more about writing this book and what you include in that book?
Yeah, it's, you know, I sat down, I don't know about most people who, you know, listen these days, how much journaling goes on, because I don't think most people seem to have the time to do much of anything these days. We're all running in too many different directions. But growing up, I always kept a journal. And I did it for a couple of reasons. One, writing helps me process a lot of my thoughts. The second is I always found it interesting year over year to sort of go back and read about different episodes. And as you get older, you sort of take a different view and kind of realize where you may have moved your thinking or grown a little bit. So it was my way of sort of coping with the chronic unpredictability of the treatments we were going through. So as I was writing more and more, it also allowed me an outlet to sort of work through the myriad of emotions that you go through. There's that sense of expectation. There's that sense of, oh, wow, is this month going to be different? There's that sense of frustration of not being understood. There's the, you know, the moments of just sheer, you know, anger that, you know, you feel like you've done everything right and nothing seems to be working. And as I sat down, I realized that there was no real, back to your point earlier, cultural framework to put this in. I often compared it to, you know, when you're going through high school, you know, at some point you're going to be a senior. For some of us, you know, we're preparing to maybe take the next step, which might involve going to college. And there's this sort of natural, I guess, timeline that you're working along and you feel like you're sort of moving from one step to another. And there are those people to sort of welcome you along, whether it's, you know, being a part of the freshman class and the upperclassmen coming down to put their arm around you and talk about what it's like to declare your, you know, your area of study or to move into a new project, to get your first dorm room set up. But there was literally nothing available when I started this process that could help me understand what happens when the science doesn't work. What happens when the doctors are scratching their heads and can't tell you why you can't get pregnant? So as I started going through all this, I thought, you know, if the Pamela from 20 years ahead could come and talk to me, I'd want to know what's coming next. Mm-hmm. So I thought if I put this all down in words, it might help the next generation of women who were going to end up in the same place I was 10 years ago.
Wow, that's really awesome. And I'm sure a struggle to write those words and then also to share those with the public. But I'm sure you've touched the lives of so many people by being able to put those words down and share them with the world. So thank you for that, being vulnerable.
I appreciate that. And you know, I've often found that biographies and diaries from different periods that happened before I was born also give you a much richer understanding of the complexities of life. And this is one very big area. And I know you spent a lot of time in the labor and delivery room. Until you've really lived it, you really don't understand what someone else is going through. And so I do think those first person accounts can really light the way. And I've also been very, very much grateful for the vulnerability of others who've come to me with their stories or shared what they've gone through, because it also makes you feel understood and heard.
So pausing there to say that we want to hear women who are going through this. I want women to know that they're loved and supported going through their own infertility journey. So what would you say to them, Pamela? What would you say to women listening in who are going through this, who might be thinking about starting to approach the infertility business, or those who are kind of in the thick of it now who are wondering if it's worth it or if it's going to work? What would you say to them?
I think the first thing that I would say is know that there is an inherent amount of unpredictability with this experience, and there is not any one path that is going to work for everybody. I think that is another really unique aspect to this. I've known women who have had really significant difficulty getting pregnant. I've known others who have had no problem getting pregnant, but had very, very big problems maintaining a pregnancy. And so knowing that there is no one size fits all is really important. Also, if you feel that you are not getting adequately heard or cared for, certainly be your own patient advocate and make sure that you are getting your questions answered. Do reach out to others who have been through this to help illuminate maybe some of the questions or concerns that are starting to develop, because there is, as we all know, we all respond to these things differently. I know some women who are very open and have no problem sharing every aspect of what they're living through, and others who feel more private or guarded about it. There's no right or wrong answer here, but you will know what your own needs are. And I think that's one other thing that I've heard over and over from women who, like me, have been through this. It's very helpful to sit down and maybe think through where your comfort level is. How far in the invasiveness are you comfortable with? If you can set down early and try to map out different scenarios, it may make it a little easier so that you're not forced in the moment to make some difficult decisions that you haven't really had a chance to think through. We did stage our different decisions, and we would have long conversations about them before we would get into them. And I think you will serve yourself well by trying to give yourself room to think these things through, because these are not easy decisions to make.
Sure. I think that's really great advice to kind of go through with a plan and what you think you might be able to tolerate or not during all of this. Because it seems like you talk about, and I want to switch gears just a little bit to talk about your writing Infertility and Sterility and ask you about add-on treatments to IVF. Can you talk about what those are and what you're talking about in that article?
Yeah. So there is a sort of a, and I want to make sure I don't make this sound too simplistic, because those who work in the science and medical world, I'm sure will push back pretty hard if I make this sound a little bit too one-dimensional.
Sure.
There is a set of pretty understood protocols for undergoing IVF. And what's happened in the last 40 plus years is that clinicians and those who are working in the lab world have been trying to understand at what point during the course of IVF can they improve upon the potential of success. And so as most people understand it, and the pandemic is a perfect opportunity to provide a parallel here, there are clinical protocols that are demanded of scientists before they put a particular, whether it's a vaccine, whether it is a procedure, into practice. The FDA, the CDC, the American Medical Association, the Association for Reproductive Medicine, they all have different standards for what is acceptable, and it has to be proven evidence-based. There are certain ways of ensuring that you are acting in the best interests of your patients. Now, all that being said, there's also a lot of money to be made from the fertility world. And so there have been, over the course of the last decade or two, a number of attempts to try to introduce new procedures into the IVF process. One in particular is a procedure that was called embryo glue. And it sounds weird, but it's got a scientific name along with it. And this was a particular medium that they would sell to couples as a way to improve the odds of an embryo successfully implanting. And as it's sold, it's a one-off. So they'll say to you as you're sitting down to put your IVF procedure in place, are you interested in embryo glue? Well, as a person sitting across the table from a scientist or a nurse or a doctor who's got a checklist of what they're going to be including in your IVF procedure, embryo glue sounds like something you'd want because you want to ensure that there's a successful implantation. But what they don't always tell you is that that is a procedure that has had mixed results. And has not been 100% validated in terms of being necessary for your IVF to be successful. So that embryo glue is an add-on. It's, sold for anywhere from $700 to $1,500. And so as you're sitting there with your budget trying to understand, let's see, the IVF drugs are going to cost between $5,000 and $10,000. The actual procedure is anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000. If you're going to do an intracytoplasmic sperm injection, which at one time was described as an IVF add-on, some don't consider it anymore, which is where they actually, will inject the sperm directly into the egg rather than let the sperm penetrate in the lab on its own. Those all have a line item associated with it. So I guess to make the best analogy here, it would be like going into a typical hamburger stand and saying, look, I'll have the mustard, I'll take the pickles, I'll take the onions. Can I get a side of your secret sauce? So when you're a patient, they're laying out all these options that are potentially available, but not all of them have been clinically proven. And because of that, patients are not necessarily being well served.
So to go back to your earlier point, how can women and couples kind of make a plan for what they will and won't do if they've got all of these extra things that they may or may not understand? It seems kind of hard to really have or make an informed decision about how you're going to navigate this world if you're not completely sure what's being offered and whether or not it's any good. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I've been pretty bold in making some demands of the reproductive medicine practitioners and to really try to help them understand that, for the most part, patients have not had the depth of understanding about what is ahead of them, and that it's incumbent upon the industry to really police itself. And I've really encouraged those who work and operate around the world of OBGYNs and those who are involved in guiding people to reproductive endocrinologists to ensure that they ask some very pointed questions. First, does the clinic or the clinic owners have any financial involvement in the outcome of the procedures they're selling? Many of the clinic operators actually have their own stake in the add-ons they're selling. So they may be medical advisors to startups who are trying to build a business around a new fertility treatment add-on. So I think as a patient, it's really important to ask up front, does the clinic earn any added money by selling this procedure? Would you do this procedure yourself? Would you advise this if this were your son or daughter? And really hold them accountable. I want to get back to the fact that not every person who sells IVF is necessarily somebody you need to be afraid of. But I do think there's been a fairly bad track record of clinics that have somehow decided that this is a really good way to create a profit center.
Sure. And it seems I had a gal on the show the other day, and we were kind of talking about that. Yeah. So there's a quote that I found that some doctors are disturbed by the business influence on what they see as a sacred trust between physicians and patients. And it sounds like kind of what you're talking about. Perhaps some clinics are working in an industry rather than working for people or for a medical specialty.
That's right. In fact, one of the largest fertility clinic chains, if you look at it, interestingly, they are the same people who are underwriting a lot of the campaigns to get IVF treatment coverage expanded. And so you have to ask yourself, is there a conflict of interest in the very clinics that are trying to drive more throughput to their clinic being the ones advocating for more insurance coverage? So to me, it really is a question for the bioethicists. You know, ultimately, you want to believe that if you're going to see a physician to help you with a problem, that they're not looking at you as a bank account rather than an individual who's looking for valued, trusted care.
I want to talk to you about your other book. But before we do that, since we're kind of on the topic of new technologies and new offerings from the fertility industry, it seems like egg freezing is kind of the newest trend and the newest kind of moneymaker. And I recently had a woman on the podcast that had frozen her eggs, and she really felt like this was the best way and the only way to really secure her future as a mother. So what are your thoughts on social egg freezing? We've talked a lot about IVF, but what about this kind of new hot thing?
Yeah, there's been a fair amount of consternation about the fact that this particular procedure was put into practice very early in the understanding of the success rates. There was a rush to move this from experimental into the latest offering by clinics seeking to expand their reach into a larger population of patients. For years, the vast majority of individuals who would meet with a reproductive endocrinologist were individuals who had a demonstrated inability to successfully get pregnant on their own. Today, clinics are actually creating a separate branch so that they're not putting women who are healthy in the same clinic waiting rooms as women who've been diagnosed with infertility conditions, because they don't want to necessarily create this strange encounter where you're selling somebody a future on a potential pregnancy down the road to a perfectly healthy woman sitting next to another woman who's been diagnosed with, you know, very severe endometriosis. They're two very different sales, if you will. And so ultimately, I think that social egg freezing needed to have a little bit more demonstrated evidence-based medicine before it was put into a very broad distribution. The real sad element associated with this, and I've talked to some women who've gone through the procedure, is they were led to believe that they were buying an insurance policy on the future. And what they discovered when they went to have their vitrified eggs prepared for what will be an ICSI IVF procedure, because the actual egg cells become much thicker, the lining requires an intracytoplasmic sperm injection in order to successfully fertilize the egg. And then they go through the rest of the IVF process, that some of the eggs did not succeed in the thawing and some of the eggs didn't succeed in fertilization. So there is this real misnomer out there about this being a sort of a catch-all for setting your, you know, deferring your motherhood, deferring your parenthood. And ultimately, it's not always going to be that outcome.
And a lot of, so I live in the Bay Area, and a lot of the big tech companies are starting to offer this as, you know, as part of their package. You know, we'll pay for your egg freezing when you work for us. So that, you know, I always kind of think about the conflicts of interest and kind of what you said earlier, some of these clinics are the ones kind of pushing it that direction. Very interesting. Your second book, let's kind of go back to you again. I know we're kind of all over the place on this interview, but there's so much to talk about. Your second book, which is actually an ebook called Finally Heard, that moves from what I understand from, I haven't read the book, moves from your personal experience to kind of examine what you call Generation IVF. So can you tell us more about that book and your process for writing that book and what you hope to get out of that book?
Yeah, it's a very short, and my intent in writing it was to make it easily consumed. It really came out of the fact that by the time I'd finished Silent Sorority, there was a level of peace and equanimity that my husband and I had with making the decision that we did. But there were more than a few people who said to me, it felt like your story still had one more chapter. So I ended up writing Finally Heard about 5 years later, and start with what it felt like to go back to the same hospital where I had been through several of my IVF procedures. And there was an acupuncturist that I had worked with for two reasons. One, I find acupuncture can be remarkably helpful with just overall sort of mental health. It does really provide a relaxation. And at the same time, I knew that this was the same person who had met with me during my IVF. And we hadn't talked to each other in several years. So that became the basis. The first chapter of Finally Heard is sort of the last chapter of Silent Sorority in some ways. But from there, I really delve into this silent community of women who exist in society whose stories are not heard. And there are women who have gone through the trauma of IVF failure, and the societal weirdness that we all encounter by virtue of not having an adequate platform to discuss what it's like to have prepared yourself for a family only to discover that that family you worked so hard to create didn't materialize. And so it's a real interesting cross-section of voices of women I'd come to know through my blogging, writing, and research, some of whom had children with IVF and some of whom did not. But what we all collectively agreed is that the actual experience of IVF creates its own long-lasting trauma. And there are still a number of women who have had children through IVF who get very emotional when an unexpected pregnancy announcement is in their workplace or introduced into one of their, you know, family social engagements, because they never actually were able to spontaneously conceive. And the difficulty of going for follow-up OBGYN appointments, because the experience of sitting in stirrups brings back the trauma of going through your egg extractions. It's another layer of complexity that doesn't get discussed often in society. And Finally Heard sort of put some of those into the dialogue.
Sure, because even if your IVF is successful and you have this baby from it, there, I'm sure you still have that experience that you went through for however long it was, and the struggles of going through that. I mean, I can't imagine
There was a book that was written in the 60s, which is kind of a classic, and it's worth going back to for people who might be interested. But it was a book written called Our Bodies, Ourselves, and it was
I think I've heard of this book. Yeah. It's gotten so much praise.
Yeah, I actually have one of the original copies. I found it at the University of Michigan when I was a student on campus. And they've since reissued a couple of newer editions. But what I found really interesting about the book is it was written at a time in the 60s when women didn't openly discuss their biology. So, you know, for them to sit around and talk about what it felt like to have a problematic period or to understand what a miscarriage felt like, it was a book by and for women about the experience of understanding their own bodies. And what I think is missing today is a book that would allow women who've been through some of the challenges of infertility or any kind of family building for that matter, to be able to openly discuss all of the things that are not acceptable in today's society. And I'm not suggesting that you should go to your, you know, neighborhood potluck and start talking about all the difficulties with your hormones, but there still needs to be some space and some understanding that, you know, family building writ large is nowhere near as simple, straightforward, or in the case of a lot of the way that it's presented by the fertility industry and by sort of mainstream women's magazines, as, you know, always being easy, and that there's, you know, no lack of complexity underneath. You know, if I can pivot for just a minute, and this is not the topic of our conversation today, but I was really struck by a story in today's New York Times. And it's a piece about motherhood and the fact that the pandemic has really forced women who are trying to work a full-time job, raise children, keep their own sanity. It's put it all under such a pressure cooker. And the women are actually saying in this story, the pandemic has sort of made it clear to me that maybe I wasn't cut out to be a parent. And I think having those opportunities to really discuss that we have been so sort of, I guess, silenced and censored in what's acceptable to discuss. And it's really done a disservice to people who don't fit the real norm that is presented in our day-to-day lives.
For sure, for sure. And I've seen that too, like some of the girls at work and have littles at home, they've also seen, not that any of them have voiced that, but they feel too that like we're kind of going back to it's the woman's responsibility to take care of the child, and their jobs are kind of being pushed back during this time. So that's an interesting article. I'll have to look that up. It sounds like in discussing with you and talking with you, and we'll kind of wrap it up with the last couple of questions. It sounds like you have wanted to push back a little bit against the industry to make it safer for women, and then also give women a space so that they can talk about this. Tell me more about ReproTech Truths. It seems like this was kind of part of that, and your hashtag and trying to push back. Was that successful? Tell me more about that program.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that if nothing else, I've distinguished myself as being an individual that the industry probably groans when they hear my name. I'm not afraid to really ask tough questions and to hold them accountable, because there has been a complicit sort of nature of the way this procedure was put into practice and then grown over the last couple of decades. And I want to hold them to a higher standard in terms of what is, you know, expected both of them as practitioners, and also how they can better serve, you know, very vulnerable individuals who are coming to meet and have discussions about really big decisions they're facing as, you know, potential parents. And ultimately, Reprotect Truths was a bit of a brainchild between myself and a couple of other women who realized that every time there was a one-decade shift in the time since Louise Joy Brown was born, that there was this cheerleading squad that would start about a year in advance. And it was underwritten by the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. It was in conjunction with some of the larger clinics that operate around the world. And ultimately, to some extent, they've co-opted some of the folks who are involved in Resolve, which was started as a grassroots patient and sort of support network that has since been funded by the very industry that they were, you know, ultimately trying to figure out. And I'll be a little more upfront about that. If you look at the donors and the supporters of the Resolve organization, they are the pharmaceutical companies that sell drugs to clinics. They are the clinics that actually have expanded their offerings, selling IVF add-ons that haven't been scientifically proven. So there's a little bit of the co-opting of patients to serve the needs of the industry, which I think is a rather unfortunate turn in the way that the organization has developed. But back to your other questions. So we knew when it was the 40th anniversary that there was going to be a whole series of campaigns to get clinics and patients to talk about all of the children who were conceived via IVF. Fine, that's their prerogative. But what the industry wasn't doing was providing equal time for the number of patients and couples and individuals who'd gone through the various procedures that were offered that never succeeded. And in doing so, we discovered that while the industry was talking about the 6 million children who'd been born over 40 years, the industry wasn't describing the 20 million cycles that had failed. So we decided to give women a chance to talk about their experience on the stories that were not getting pitched to People magazine and being broadcast on Good Morning America.
Seems like everyone wants to hear the success story, but no one wants to hear the pain and the anguish behind some of those success stories that, you know. So would you say the hashtag was successful?
It was. Reprotect Truths still exists today. The purpose behind it was to tie it to the 40th anniversary. And ultimately, women have had the chance to read each other's stories and to find comfort in knowing that they were not the only ones who had had difficulty with OHSS, which is ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. There were a number of other stories about women who had had some real difficult long-term health issues as a result of being megadosed by hormones that were part of their treatment. There's quite a few stories about the lack of emotional support that was very much a dereliction of duty on the part of clinics who just left women to their own devices after multiple losses. And so ultimately, it was our opportunity to try to shine a spotlight on areas that the industry writ large needs to focus on and to ensure that safety and efficacy and overall well-being are never far from the priority.
And compassion and care, you know, caring for the whole woman, the whole couple, right?
So absolutely.
Have you seen since then, I know it's only been a short time, but have you seen any changes that have shown progress? Have you seen changes that clinics are offering more of a robust approach to caring for the individual?
Well, I found it really curious. So it was literally a year after my op-ed ran in the New York Times about the IVF add-on racket. And by the way, the New York Times editors chose that headline. I was actually surprised that they were willing to use the word racket because I would have used it, but that was their choice. So kudos to them for seeing it for what it was. And ultimately, I received a phone call from a friend of mine in London who called to tell me that my New York Times op-ed was being read aloud at a medical bioethicist conference being hosted at Harvard a year after the op-ed ran. And so I contacted Harvard later in the day and asked if the webinar was available, a seminar that they had planned to do in person, but the pandemic turned it into distributed Zoom session instead. And it turns out that the head of the bioethics and legal team was reading the op-ed because he had spent his career in reproductive medicine and was shocked to learn that patients were being treated badly and underserved by clinics who were not doing their job informing their patients about the quality of research and the procedures that were being offered. And I think what really struck me is how insular many of the folks who work in reproductive medicine are, and the fact that they have not taken the time to really educate themselves about the patient experience.
That's crazy. And I'm sure it was very exciting for you to know that your work was being read even a year later and is making an impact. That's awesome.
Well, it's an uphill battle, and I've had conversations with other patient advocates in other countries, and I would say that the UK certainly leads because they actually have a national board that routinely grades the reproductive industry in the UK and gives the industry a report card on how well they're serving their patients. And it's a 360 review. I think it would be really useful if we had something like that in the United States.
It's always interesting how different countries are tackling what I call big fertility or the fertility industry. We are very close out of time. I don't want to keep you much longer. Do you have anything else that you would like to add before we go, Pamela?
I think the most important thing is if you know somebody in your family or your workplace are struggling with fertility issues, to really steer them to a place where they feel they can safely describe what they're going through and to provide that ready willingness to listen and to give them whatever sort of space they need to work through what are ultimately some very, very life-changing decisions.
Thank you so much for that, Pamela. And thank you for taking the time to be on our show today and share your story. It's been a privilege to have you on Venus Rising. I'd like to thank each and every listener and subscriber for listening in. Our goal is, as ever, to create conversation, to facilitate these types of discussions, and encourage you to think beyond the masses.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.